Hello and welcome to Conversations About Alcohol, a chance to step back from the coalface of general practice and learn from others on how to improve and inform our chats with patients about the harms of alcohol. I'm delighted today to be joined by Marie Todd, Minister for Drug and Alcohol Policy and Sport. Hello, Marie.
Good morning. It's really lovely to be with you.
That sport bit is very important, isn't it?
It is. I do love sport. I am actually, I found in this role, I'm passionate about very many sports, but I was a big rugby player and rugby fan in my youth, and I mean, it's a funny week to admit it, but I love yes. Gregor Townsend so much, I named my child after him.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, we're big into sport in our family.
That's lovely. Yeah, it's probably best not to talk about the rugby just now. Marie, thank you so much for joining us. You know, I met you briefly before, and I was really struck by how open you're willing to be about your own experience. But before we get into that, I'd like to hear a little bit more about your professional role. You know, the fact that we even have a Minister for Drug and Alcohol Policy strikes me as significant.
I mean, I think it's significant but necessary in Scotland. Mm. I think we've got a long, unhealthy relationship with alcohol. Mm. And in recent decades, actually, ever since I was a young woman, we've had a lot of difficulty with drugs as well. So I think it's perfectly understandable that we have a Minister for Drug and Alcohol Policy. And I guess, personally and professionally, I mean, I often talk about how I took on this role. The First Minister asked me, would I take on this role? And I try to say without sounding deluded, I think I was made for this role. Mm, mm. I love it. Mm. I spent 20 years working as a mental health pharmacist. Mm-hmm. Having got back into this, you know, into this job, I've realised, gosh, I do actually really love drugs. Mm. I'm interested in them. Mm. I have a lot of experience with mental illness, not specialising in addiction, but there's a huge overlap, yeah. Clearly. I then, all the ministerial roles that I've had, being Minister for Children and Young People, Minister for Social Care, Minister for Mental Wellbeing, I feel have all helped me to understand what you can do in the face of challenges, which is very helpful for this role. Mm. And then my personal experience, I have lived experience. I grew up in a family of, in an alcoholic household, as we say. My parents were both alcoholics. That's the word that we use. I know that it's laden, mm-hmm. and not everyone likes that word. Mm. But that's the word that both my parents used to describe themselves. And, you know, I think my parents have been sober for 4 decades. My mum died a couple of years ago, but this year my dad celebrated his 40th anniversary sober. Mm. And I just think what we're, both of us, you know, I phoned my dad when I got the job and he was so excited, and straight away talking about how we talk about that experience because it's such a powerful symbol of hope for people.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm inclined to agree, Marie. I think you are made for this job. And, you know, what does the job involve? What kind of things is the Minister for Drug and Alcohol Policy looking at the moment in Scotland?
So at the moment, we're at the point where we're coming towards the end of what we call the national mission. We have a pretty devastating death toll from drugs in Scotland. Mm. And in 2021, we declared an emergency and put significant sums of money towards that national mission, trying to improve, firstly trying to reduce the deaths, so a lot of harm reduction effort, broadening access to the naloxone programme, things like that, but also increasing the availability and accessibility of residential rehab. So we're coming towards the end of that national mission. Mm-hmm. And we are looking to move towards this year, we'll be in the next few weeks, in fact, be launching an alcohol and drug strategy. So it's quite a pivotal moment in the role, thinking about what have we done that's made a difference, mm-hmm. what are the challenges that we're facing ahead, mm-hmm. and what do we need to keep investing in and keep prioritising. Mm-hmm. We have, as well as our drugs death challenge, so we lose, you know, last year we lost just over 1,000 people to to drug deaths. Mm. As well as that, though, we have a really terrible alcohol death toll. Mm. So last year we lost nearly 1,200 people directly to alcohol deaths. Those are just, and those are the direct deaths, so those are just the tip of the iceberg. Mm. Those aren't the cardiovascular deaths or the cancer deaths that might be related to alcohol. Those are the direct, usually liver failure deaths. And it's just devastating. I mean, we're a small country. We can't afford to be losing a couple of thousand people
every year. Yeah.
So we have made progress. We've definitely made progress. And for the alcohol deaths, for example, we are heading in the right direction. Mm-hmm. But we have a long way to go, a long way to go. And it's, I think it's really important. I mean, that's probably the most important part of the portfolio is focusing, never taking my eye off the drugs desk. Now, there's lots of other things. We are obviously, everybody in a role like mine as a ministerial role, you're trying to get upstream, you're trying to get into prevention, all of these things. And I think it's really important we don't ignore that.
Yeah.
There's specific people who we know are at risk of becoming addicted and at risk of dying. And we've got particular programs targeted at that. We've got general population level measures that we're taking. All of these things are really important. But I think the drug and alcohol deaths, the direct deaths, are probably the most important.
Yeah, you know, whenever I started this podcast series, met with the directors of SHAP, and we talked about how the deaths directly caused by alcohol are a very useful proxy for the overall harm caused by alcohol, because they're the one thing you can measure cleanly, but by no means do they amount to all the harm.
They don't capture all the harm. I mean, they don't even capture all the deaths.
Yeah.
And if I think about, you know, children like me growing up in alcohol-soaked households,
yes,
and all the harm that comes from that.
Yes,
that's not even captured in a statistic at all.
No,
I know. I mean, I was actually working as a mental health pharmacist in a psychiatric hospital when minimum unit pricing came in, and I'm not kidding. I did a little dance of delight. Mm. And myself and my colleagues looked at that policy and we thought, my goodness, that is a sophisticated response to the situation that we face in Scotland. That will definitely, if you think of alcohol consumption, you know, from nothing to low level to, you know, dangerous and hazardous and deaths.
Yeah.
Shifting the curve.
Yeah.
Towards
yeah.
healthy.
Yeah.
And fewer children growing up in households like I grew up in.
Yeah, a world national first, actually.
Absolutely.
That policy.
So really clever, didn't hit the producers at all, despite all the years of wrangling over in court over whether it was possible to introduce that policy. But it was cleverly designed to not impact their income. But reduce the amount of alcohol that was consumed.
Yeah, it was a huge win for us here. Are there any other policies that we should be aware of working in primary care that are affecting alcohol harms? Or?
So I think the increase in access to residential rehab, which has happened over the course of the national mission, has actually really benefited people who drink alcohol. And I think primary care, I don't know, over the course of the last maybe 10 years, I would say, primary care has become a little bit more fragmented. And I think that people are presenting very late in the course of the illness. I do think of alcohol dependence as an illness.
Yes.
People are presenting very late in the course of their illness. And often, I think in primary care, there's a sense, I don't know where to put these people, I don't know where I can send them to get help, and I'm not sure that help is available. And I suppose one message I would be very keen for people to understand is that there is help available. Nobody should be turned away from accessing residential care due to lack of resources. We have pumped a ton of money into increasing the capacity of residential care and increasing the funded places. And even if the local ADP has used up its funding, there is now an additional pot of money that can be used. So once your own funding is used up, there's an additional pot that you can access. So if that is the right treatment option for an individual patient, that should be available in a way which it wasn't before the national mission.
That's really good to hear, you know, because I also interviewed David McCartney, who ran LEAP for many years. And this podcast hopefully will be listened to people throughout Scotland. And it didn't sound like there was a huge amount of residential rehab available throughout Scotland, but it's increasing. Is that
what
we're
saying? We've seriously increased the capacity. I think it's gone up by almost a third.
Wow.
I'm desperately trying to remember the figures, but it has gone up significantly, the amount of funded places.
Yeah.
About 1,000 people a year are getting a funded place. And we've, you know, literally built new units.
Great, yeah.
In order, you know, I went up and opened one in Inverness, which is particularly targeting people who live in the rural Highlands and Islands. So we have looked not just at increasing the capacity, but increasing the accessibility.
Yes.
So people who struggled to access that type of care before should find it significantly more straightforward. Now, that's not to say there are no barriers in place. Mm-hmm. You don't. And I think there's a naivety in I wouldn't expect it in a clinical audience, but amongst the public.
Yes.
About how straightforward it is to go from dependence into recovery.
Yeah.
And as one of the things I regularly say is that abstinence is not recovery. You know, just stopping the substance doesn't mean that you're cured. Mm-hmm. People have told me that loud and clear. That was my own family's experience of recovery. There's a lot of challenge and rebuilding that needs to happen during, you know, once somebody has stopped the substance. That's really just the first step. But increasing access to treatment, recognising the harmful drinking earlier on, increasing support for, I mean, one of the passions I have, and we'll get onto it when we talk about my own personal experiences, that I think that health professionals ought to be a little bit more familiar and a little bit more comfortable with recommending groups like Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
So the fellowship-based 12-step programs, which are really, really effective.
Yeah, yeah. and something we know much about often.
No, and you know, the evidence base would support their recommendation, but there's loads of myths about them.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's lots of work we need to do.
Mm. I think this is a really important message for us GPs, Marie, because especially if we've been working for a while and we have the feeling that there really isn't much out there, we can end up in a bit of a sort of, I don't know, professional nihilism kind of, where we feel a bit futile about it all. And it's really helpful to hear, no, you know, actually the resources available are increasing. This is more on the agenda, and we shouldn't assume that there isn't anything we can do to help.
Absolutely. So it's really important. I mean, definitely avoid that nihilism. Mm. It is possible. And I suppose one of the reasons I love this job, and if you think about my politics, I'm somebody who wants a profound change for Scotland.
Yeah.
I want a different kind of country.
Mm.
And there are certainly times when I think, oh my goodness, that's a tough gig. Maybe it's not going to happen.
Mm.
Well, there's nothing more exciting than spending time with people in recovery who have been in the absolute depths of despair, where every continuing looked impossible, never mind change.
Yes.
And bang, they've done it.
Yes, yeah.
And their lives have been transformed.
Yeah.
So never lose that hope.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, I meet day in, day out, people who you would never imagine were able to sustain recovery and are.
Yeah.
If I think of my own family experience, it wasn't really until I was an adult and working in mental health that I realised how unusual it was to have two parents who drank who had both stopped.
Mm.
You know, that's a tricky thing.
Mm.
And they both managed to stop at the same time and to stay sober from that point on. They had different sort of recovery journeys, but that is unusual.
Mm.
And that transformed my life.
Mm-hmm.
It transformed my sister's life.
Mm-hmm.
It changed the course of our family's life. So yeah. Never, ever lose hope.
That's what we've actually, you know, been talking about, is that one of our roles as GPs is to hold the hope when people feel totally hopeless. And, you know, initially as a GP trainee, I found consults where folk were confiding in me about how much they were drinking and maybe the trauma that lay under that, totally overwhelming. And now with a little bit of experience, I'm finding them more and more sort of my most fulfilling consults, because of, you know, just realizing that, you know, a bit of conversation, a bit of steerage and a bit of support can actually really help. And that's really gratifying to be able to witness.
Absolutely. So if they're sharing with you, they are at a point where they want things to change. And it is a chance to get in there and to support that change.
What was it, if you don't mind me asking, that helped your folks come to that point where they were ready to change?
So it's funny, when I've chatted to both my mum and dad, things were quite different for both of them. My dad had got himself into real bother with alcohol. He was a traditional drinker, so just a traditional West Highland man who went to the pub after work with all of his pals, and, you know, by the time he was ready to stop, was physically dependent. Had lost his driving license, lost his job. So consequences were starting to hit him hard. I mean, I say physically dependent, but I don't think he ever once went to a GP for help. And I don't think he ever was came to the attention of medics, actually. Despite the level of difficulties he was facing. So he needed to get his job back, and his boss actually was very helpful in that, and said, you know, his boss batted for him at the employment tribunal that he was facing, and his boss said, listen, you're going to have to stay sober. You know, you can't drink again, or you're definitely going to lose your job next time. And I think actually it was that confidence in him. I live in a wee West Highland village, and it's quite a close-knit community. And somebody from AA, and it's actually, you know, he's still like a village elder, reached out to my dad, knew he was in difficulty with alcohol, and said, how about you come along to an AA meeting? And my dad went along to just this one meeting, and that was it, never drank again, and never went back to AA. So basically, that was it. Took his last drink. I think it might have been on the morning of the tribunal. I would have to check that detail with Dad, but it was literally right up to that point, and then stopped, and that was it. My mum was persuaded to go along to AA, again by the same chap, who became her sponsor. She stayed with AA, and he persuaded her that it was quite common for spouses to go along.
So she wasn't going for herself.
She was going for my dad.
And
she said that's quite common. And she sat there at that first meeting and heard everyone telling their testimony and thought, my goodness, this is me, actually. She drank in a different way. She wasn't, I don't think, physically dependent, and probably had come to the attention of doctors more because her health hadn't been great. She went along to that AA meeting, realised they're talking about me. This is, you know, I can identify with this, and carried on with AA from that point onwards.
So AA really worked for her. It really spoke to her.
I mean, my dad actually feels guilty about not continuing with AA. So my dad would say AA worked for him too.
Yes, well, one meeting, in fact, it was so effective, it only needed one meeting.
And he always says his regret, one regret in life, is that he didn't carry on with it, because most people need to carry on with it.
Right.
And he thinks he sets a bad example. However, mum found a very, very helpful and continued right up until, you know, when actually when she died a couple of years ago, her funeral was lovely. And we were able, myself and my sister Fiona, were able to very directly thank people in the fellowship for the difference that they had made to our lives. It was very moving to hear how many people she had helped. So that's part of being in the fellowship, is that you continue and support other people. So it was very powerful. It was an insight into a community that has been there our whole lives, but we're not part of.
Yes, yeah.
And it was a very powerful opportunity for us to say thank you and for them all to say thank you to us.
Yeah.
It was really.
You think about the effect that it had on your whole family and therefore your upbringing and your future and your prospects.
Absolutely. So I say hand on heart to people, I would never be in this job. If my parents hadn't got sober. There is my life trajectory changed completely at that point.
How old were you when your parents became
sober? Let me think. I think I was about 10. So when I think of it, and I suppose I'm 53 now, so it gets a bit hard to disentangle your childhood. My parents were pretty good in my early years.
Yeah.
Then I went to school at 4, and I think my mum's drinking really escalated. I was the youngest, so my mum's drinking escalated when I went to school and lasted for most of my primary school years. And then, you know, sobriety came in our secondary school years. It was tricky though. So my mum, unlike my dad, my mum had a much more non-linear recovery, I would say it's probably more common that, you know, stopped drinking and fell off the wagon a number of times.
Relapses and then...
Yeah, and that relapse remitting sort of pattern for a few years. But, you know, sober for a very, very long time by the time she passed. And we had we've had a lot of years of recovery. I mean, I've had friends whose parents have died in addiction and it's just devastating. We've had all those years to talk about what happened, how it happened, to understand it. I've had the chat. I mean, my mum, I've often reflected, if I were in my mum's shoes, I'm not sure I would have got sober. I mean, that is a tough gig.
That's a very tough gig.
To face up. So she loved being a mother. We were the most important thing in her life. And... you know, by her own standards, she had let us down.
Yeah.
And she had all sorts of challenges psychologically that made her drink in the first place, as anyone who drinks heavily does.
Yeah.
Then, as anyone who drinks heavily, there are consequences from that that you have to face up to when you're sober. It's easier to stay drunk.
Yeah.
And then, you know, rebuilding relationships and things. She was quite a phenomenal woman, actually.
The sheer courage to face your shame and your regrets.
And women get it harder.
Interesting. Why do you say women get it harder?
So I think women face more judgment generally, don't we? Let's face it. Then, actually, in even, and I am a staunch feminist, which I got from my mum. However feminist you are, the reality is that women carry the burden of caring. Your mum not being well is probably more significant as a child than your dad not being well. The consequences are more severe if your mum is not well. So I think all of those things. And I mean, I grew up in a traditional West Highland village where alcohol is everywhere, but judgment's quite close to the surface as well. And, you know, I joke about it now. I say I grew up in a very gendered part of the world because I realise it's not like that down here in the south of Scotland, that women are expected to take on certain roles and men are expected to take on certain roles. And, you know, probably my mum got into drinking at a time when it was only just socially acceptable for women to drink alcohol.
Yeah, yeah.
In my part of the country.
And I'm also just thinking about her being in such a small community where everyone knows everyone's business.
I know. And I think there's pros and cons in that. So myself and Fiona, my sister, have chatted an awful lot about that. And we think one of the things that protected us psychologically was that we never normalised it. Mm. We knew it wasn't. That wasn't what was happening in every other household. Yeah. And we never hid it. So because we grew up in the small community where everyone knew each other's businesses, and the consequences of both my parents drinking was quite apparent to the community, we never carried that burden of hiding it, which I think is really harmful for children.
Yeah, I think that's so insightful of you to realise actually there would have been an extra level of harm if this was all hidden and somehow internalised as your problem. And your...
I mean, don't get me wrong, I think all children of alcoholics think it is their problem and they have to fix it. Mm-hmm. This is, you know... I've often thought, why did I become a health professional?
Yeah, well,
so lots of common. Lots of people who grow up in an alcoholic household feel responsibility, shame, and I was no different.
Yeah,
I never, though, had that burden of trying to cover up what was happening at home.
Yeah.
There was a tacit understanding with my community that they knew what was happening at home.
Yes.
I didn't, you know, I think I meet people day in day out. Actually, last week I met the charity NACOA, so the National Association of Children of Alcoholics, and many of the people involved in that charity have lived experience like I do of growing up in an alcoholic household. They do amazing work. And that's another thing that people in primary care should know about. That's a real resource for children.
Right.
So they were in doing an educational piece in a school, and they did it really well. And we were chatting about life experience, and both of the individuals, in fact, all three of the individuals who I spoke to had carried that burden of trying to hide what was happening at home.
Yeah.
And I realised again just how liberating it was for me. It was bad.
Yes.
You know, so. By the time my parents stopped drinking, my friends weren't allowed to come round to our house and play.
Yes, yeah.
Because it wasn't safe for them.
Yes.
So it was grim.
Yes.
But...
it wasn't hidden.
It wasn't
hidden. And you were seen by your community.
And people looked after me. So I often think it takes a village to raise a child. I had a brilliant village.
Yeah.
So if I needed fed... I could go next door and get fed.
Yeah.
Even to the point, I mean, the last Christmas before my mum died at Christmas. This is a terrible, slightly black humour story. My mum died on Christmas Day, which everybody thinks is grim. Mm. And Fiona and I were saying, well, that wasn't the worst Christmas we had.
No.
So the last Christmas before my parents stopped drinking, there was no food in the house. And we weren't having Christmas dinner. And we were kind of, both my parents were quite intoxicated, and we were quite, you know, we knew Christmas Day isn't a day when you can drop in on your pals. Anyway, we went next door to our friends, and they were all having their dinner in the dining room. So we just kind of sat in the living room and waited for them to come out, and eventually one of the young people in the family came through. Now, he was an adult by then, and he found these two wee girls in the living room and just took us through, sat down at the table and... Joined Christmas with them.
Yeah.
So I lived in a good community.
Yeah.
Where people cared for me, people knew that my family was in difficulty. They loved my parents as well.
Yeah.
So they knew that we were in difficult times and they helped us. I often have regrets. I think of my children. You know, my middle daughter had a wee girl whose mum had challenges with drugs, and I thought that wee girl would never come over the threshold of my door looking for help.
Mm-hmm. You mean like we're sort of losing that sense of community a bit, aren't we?
So who just pops into the next door neighbour
exactly.
and gets fed nowadays.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that is a massive loss, actually. And, you know, thinking about, you mentioned that organisation, I have to be honest, I've not heard of it. Can you say it again?
So NACOA. So National Association of Children of Alcoholics. So they have a helpline, yeah. which I think, and they are very strong on the, you know, it's, I can't remember, they've got an acronym for it, but of course I can't remember it. I'm rubbish at banging out these things.
No, it's fine, we'll put a link, don't worry.
But basically, you know, they're very strong at educating children. It's not your fault, it's not your responsibility.
Yeah.
And here's where you can get help and support.
Yeah.
And the education work that they were doing, I mean, I think that type of education can be done quite clunkily and
yes.
badly, but
yes.
actually, as you would expect, because it's coming from a place of lived experience, it was being done very sensitively and powerfully.
Okay.
And I was pretty impressed by what I saw. And they have a helpline that children can call. I guess that adults, I mean, one of the things we chatted about is that adults feel overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
So teachers who may well know that there is an alcohol problem in a household
mm-hmm.
are worried about how to help,
mm-hmm.
How to help without making things worse
mm-hmm.
or tougher.
Yeah.
And these are, you know, I've just told a grim story about my own child, so these are distressing things for adults.
They are.
To hear.
Yeah.
So empowering and enabling adults to hear stories like that and recognise challenges that children are facing and to do something positive about them, I think, is all good stuff.
Oh, I've heard of Al-Anon, I've heard of Scottish families.
So NACOA didn't exist when I was young. I think it's only been around since the 1990s. And I think Al-Anon and Al-Ateen, which did exist when I was younger, I don't think Al-Ateen exists anymore.
Not heard of that one. I've heard of Al-Anon.
Yeah, so there was a similar sort of organisation within AA for children of alcoholics.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think they exist anymore, and I think NACOA is kind of the alternative.
Yeah.
As I say, though, the accessibility of having this helpline, I think, is a useful thing for people to know about.
There's also, I'm going to sort of fail to remember the exact name, but like the sort of Association of for Scottish Families Affected by Alcohol.
I think is it SFAD, Scottish Families Affected by
Alcohol
and Drugs.
Because I think that's another thing that we have to bear in mind as GPs is, not only are people with addiction our patients, but we're also seeing the family members of people who have been affected by addiction and all that carries as well. And, yeah, it can be overwhelming for us as well to know how to help.
Absolutely. And, you know, where there is addiction, children are vulnerable. And these are just, I mean, myself and my sister often say, thank heavens there was no social worker looking over our shoulder.
Yeah.
You know, that challenge of getting interventions right in a situation where children are being made vulnerable by adult addiction, dependence, intoxication.
Yeah, and in fact it sounds very much from your story that your family were actually a very tight, loving family, you know.
Absolutely.
And in this tight community. And the addiction was part of the story, but not the whole story at all.
No, and I say my parents were amazing. The only thing they got wrong was a drink.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, not a bad reflection, really.
Not at all, yeah.
And the community I lived in was very, very caring and supportive. Actually, when I became a minister, when I was Minister for Children and Young People, I realised from the Growing Up in Scotland work, that is very often what I experienced as a child growing up is very often the case. So even today in Scotland, children living in rural communities are less likely to fall through the net, more likely to be supported by their community than children in urban areas. So particularly crucial for parent, where the adults in the community know the parents and know, you know, who these children belong to, children are safer.
That makes sense.
It
does. Makes sense, yeah. And it strikes me that, you know, your folks have done this beautiful job of being open and honest and facing their demons.
Very.
And, yeah, sort of now sharing with us as well.
So as I say, when I became minister for drug and alcohol policy, I phoned my dad and I said, and I'd already spoken about growing up in an alcoholic household, but I knew there would be a whole level, extra level of scrutiny because I was in that role.
Yeah.
And I said, are you sure you're okay? And I mean, it's still a very stigmatised area, isn't it?
It is.
And I mean, it pains me, but recovery is stigmatised as well.
Yeah.
So I said, are you sure I'm okay to talk about it? And he's just delighted. He said, as long as you make sure you tell everyone I'm 40 years sober.
Yeah.
He's delighted.
Yeah.
He knows it's a real sign of hope. I mean, on his 40th anniversary, a young lad that I went to school with, who was a couple of years younger than me in school, who has had his own challenges with alcohol, gave my dad a wee birthday card to say what a difference it made to him seeing my dad's sobriety.
Yeah.
Been on the recovery walk, and I think... Actually, that's one of the things that they are very passionate about, is that recovery should be visible in our communities as well.
Yeah.
I think it's not, we didn't heal overnight.
No, we don't. I understand. You don't want to make it sound like it was straightforward or easy.
No, but we're a family that talk.
Yeah.
We love each other dearly, and in many ways my parents were able to express that love and care for me despite the alcohol. And we have worked at it and talked about it and reflected, and as I say, had that opportunity to go back and discuss. You know, I've been able to go to both my parents and say, well, I've been thinking about this, how did that come about? And they have been very honest, given that denial is such a characteristic of the illness.
Absolutely.
They've been very candid.
Yeah.
I think we're kind of like that personality-wise. We're pretty open.
I think, you know, that is what's so striking about this, Marie, and I just want to thank you, because I think hearing the stories of recovery and also hearing that there are different routes to recovery and it won't look the same for everyone, it won't necessarily be linear for everyone, but just being exposed to the potential and hope of recovery in a very real way helps us, because we can then, you know, feel a bit more hopeful. And
absolutely. So I joke about it. I mean, I'm like a living beacon for recovery.
Yeah.
My life was transformed by my parents' recovery.
Yeah.
I also can't possibly fall into that trap of thinking there's just one route.
No.
Because if I reflect on what my parents experienced, and this was in one household in a very small Highland village, so not wild variation available.
No.
They both drank for different reasons.
Yeah.
You know, my dad was really shy at the fundamental. This is, you know,
it gave him social confidence.
It gave him social confidence, which is just, and there was the cultural pressure on my dad, you know, lots of men
go to the pub
in the West Highlands, go to the pub. That is what, you know, it's almost like a rite of passage, isn't it?
It is.
My mum lost her dad very young in a tragic accident, which had a long-term impact on her family. My granddad was a wheeler. I mean, I feel like I've come from a different era. My granny, my mum's mum, was a herring girl, and my granddad was a wheeler. My granddad died wheeling in the 1950s. Which, you know, if you think in the era before the welfare state, had a pretty profound impact on their family. You know, a devastating impact on my mum. She was only 4 when he died. So she, I think, didn't ever feel particularly comfy in her own skin. And she drank because she wasn't, because she didn't like herself, frankly. So very different reasons to my dad. She drank in a different way. So she didn't drink all the time, although towards the end, towards her getting sober, the periods of sobriety were shorter. She was a binge drinker. Which brings it, so, you know, so things like Christmas were never great.
No.
When there was a reason to drink, life was never good at home.
Yes.
Christmas, birthdays, all of that.
Makes sense.
And then when she got sober, her recovery was, as I said, much more normal, non-linear.
Messier.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I can remember us as kids, we were devastated. So she got sober and we never saw her again because she was out at AA all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're like, flipping heck, you know, all those years of drinking and now that addiction appears to have been replaced by AA meetings.
Just thank you so much for talking to me and, you know, for just being so open. I think that, you know, just hearing recovery stories and the messiness of it, but the potential of it and the effect that it has not only on the individual but the whole family is really, really helpful. So thank you very much for coming and for talking.
I'm delighted to do it. And as I say, I feel like I myself am a living beacon of hope. I've got a grandbaby now. And I think, you know, if my parents hadn't stopped drinking, my life would have been so different.
Yeah.
My relationships, which are very secure, would have been very different.
Yeah.
My academic potential, my ability to do this job, just everything, everything that I have is thanks to the fact that they got sober.
And if your dad is listening to this, hello to John. Thank you.
He's even more a beacon of hope.
Thank you very much, Maria.
No bother.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to Conversations About Alcohol. Be sure to follow and like the podcast to be updated when new episodes are released.